Welcome to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curley not. He will be back tomorrow, we trust. He had a pre-scheduled eye appointment today. Filling in for him, as is often the case here, Sherry Elliker from the East Coast. Welcome aboard, Sherry. Once again, it's always a delight to have you on.
Great to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so, you know, Boeing is a huge deal here in these parts, Sherry. I mean, I grew up here, basically, and it was like we were like a one-company town. We're no longer a one-company town, and Boeing has moved its headquarters to Chicago. I mean, this is quite a while ago, but for long-timers, old-timers like me, we still remember this, and we have a kind of fondness. It might just be sentimental reasons about Boeing. There still are a lot of Boeing workers here in the region, but, boy, it's been a couple of bad news years for Boeing. And so today we're actually delighted. We've got some bad news to share with you, but also some good news. And when we have something like that, a rarity around here, good news with Boeing, we like to bring in Chris Sullivan. That's right, the cherry pie guy, Chris Sullivan. Welcome aboard, Chris. You've actually got good news for Boeing fans, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. God, it seems like I haven't talked to you, Tom, in a million years.
Yep.
Every time I tune in, you're like taking off and I'm talking to Sherry. But low blow too soon. Good to hear from you too, Sherry. But yeah, definitely good news today. I mean, Boeing finally, you know, in the black on the financial ledger for the first time in a couple of years. And I mean, not a huge amount by their standards, but enough to kind of give a little shot in the arm. They beat Wall Street expectations, which was good. And so a little bit of positive news on the financial side, just to go over it quickly. Q2 earnings about, you know, $567 million, which, you know, for most companies is good, but Boeing used to make tons more. But last year in Q2, they lost $2.4 billion. So, yeah, put that in perspective. That's a pretty good turnaround. So that's positive. There's some positive things to take away from that on the financial ledger. There's still lots of issues to deal with when it comes to the production ledger. I mean, they only delivered 79 planes in the quarter. I mean, that's still more than last year. But year-to-date, only 156, and they're still having trouble getting those maxes out to people. The Dreamliner nobody wants right now because, plus, it's grounded itself anyway as they've halted production. Boeing has to go through some fuselage shimming issues and joining issues. So, yeah, it's a mixed bag, but at least from a financial standpoint, and hearing from CEO Calhoun today, Dave, today, saying that it looks like they've kind of stopped the job cutting for right now, which is a good thing. They were expecting to cut maybe another 10,000 globally, but it looks like that's kind of on hold, which is always great news considering how many of those jobs we seem to lose that percentage, considering how many of the workforce are actually here. So that's always very, very positive news.
So what do we attribute to the positives from this year as opposed to the negatives last year? I mean, you know, commercial air travel is picking up, but not in any significant way, is it? I'm assuming that whatever profits they're making is from the defense side of things and the space side of things as opposed to the commercial side of things. Is that correct?
The commercial side is still dragging the company down. The defense and space once again leading the charge, and if it hadn't been for that side of the ledger, the last couple of years could have been even worse because with the tanker deal and whatnot and their other defense and space assets, they've been doing really well on that side. In fact, they've actually been adding employees on the defense side of the company while they've been cutting on the BCA side. So yeah, that's a certain turnaround from, you know, the Boeing you're used to, certainly, and the Boeing that I moved into here, you know, 15 or so years ago. Definitely it was the commercial side that was the bell cow, not so much anymore. So things have turned around, and air travel is back a little bit, but I mean, and I think the positive news can go to the fact that they're getting the MAXes back out. They're delivering airplanes. I mean, 50 of them this quarter, which is good, but I mean, they got a lot to get back up and running after the two tragedies.
Yeah, just to kind of catch people up. So the Maxes that had all those troubles and those two fatal crashes a couple of years ago, are they in active service? Are they flying successfully? Okay.
So, not in the huge numbers that they are still hundreds of them that they're trying to get back out of mothballs, and that's air quotes, that they had parked here in Moses Lake and any place they could find to park those planes during the pandemic when no one was flying. But that 737 is still that they're expecting that one to lead the charge, or at least the single aisle to lead the charge, because domestic flying is going to be coming back much faster, we believe, than international travel, which is where the 87 is and why the problems there. I mean, that, as I said, I mean, they've cut production on that down to next to nothing. They're figuring out some issues. And nobody wants that twin aisle plane right now because it's designed for routes that haven't really come back yet from the pandemic, those international routes.
And then one last question, Sherry, before I let you in here. I just wanted to, so Airbus must be dealing with the same kind of economic pressures as Boeing is. Are they also, at wit's end? Are they doing better than Boeing, worse than Boeing, about the same?
They're doing much better than Boeing, at least when it comes to the order book. Their backlog and their new orders and things like that are way outpacing Boeing right now. And that's a lot has to do with the fact that for a while no one was buying, or they were giving back orders on the Max because of all the concerns over it.
The lingering effects of the Max
of that disasters. are still going because people are canceling orders, doing other things, Airbus is in a position right now, unlike we've seen in the last couple of decades, where it's kind of neck and neck. One year could be one or the other. Right now, they have a chance to really kind of take the lead, and it's basically based on the fallout from those two crashes.
Okay. Mm. Sherry?
Wow. Yeah, I remember this, and you may know this detail, Chris. I think it was an interview with United Airlines president, and it was back after the two crashes. And he said that he would alert every passenger or allow them, if they found out that it was going to be a 737 MAX, not to fly on that plane if they didn't want to. Did you ever hear anything about that? Did that ever materialize where someone was actually given the notice, this is a plane that it had some problems, you're going to be flying on it. If you don't want this plane, we'll get you another flight.
I believe that did happen in some way, shape, or form. And I know a lot of people who don't really pay attention to the planes that they are flying on beforehand were certainly going out and looking to see what, if it had Max next to it, they were okay to switch their planes. Because let's face it, I mean, the mental side of this for a passenger, is quite palpable. I mean, until they figure that thing out, which they think they have. I believe that did happen. To what extent, I can't honestly say, because it's only been flying again since earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. So then, Chris, I'd like you also to address another fantastic Seattle Times article about Boeing's turnaround, how that turnaround could be threatened by the fact that they have experienced what Seattle Times lease headlines is as a talent exodus to companies like Amazon and SpaceX. Can you address, that issue, that the drain on the employees at Boeing haven't just been cutbacks? There are people, engineers, being lured to what seem to be, and at least in the most recent terms, much more successful companies like Amazon and SpaceX, Elon Musk's venture.
Well, let's first credit where credit is due. That is a Bloomberg article that was reprinted in the Seattle Times.
In the Seattle Times. Okay, fair enough.
So they did. I mean, this is one of those lengthy, like Sunday morning ones that you get into. Yes. And next thing you know, you're an hour in and four cups of coffee. And you're just like, whoa, there's just so much meat in this thing. For those people who still do that. So that's probably the two of you and one other person in the audience listening right now.
Well, summarize it for us, would you?
Yeah, so basically what it looks like is not only has Boeing been cutting positions and outsourcing positions for the last couple of decades to their detriment in some cases. A lot of these people are going not to competitors in aerospace, but to the other competitors in our region. And you mentioned Amazon One. So many people are going there because they're working on the future. They're still working in aviation because Prime Air is working on basically drones. And the aerospace that goes with delivering packages via drones or autonomous vehicles. So that appeals to the Boeing workers. And so they're, 1,100 former Boeing employees are now working at Amazon. Right now, a lot of them on that Prime Air side, certainly because you can make more money for Amazon, and you don't have to move.
They're
your
not
families.
Working in the warehouses.
No, no. These people. I mean, there is a huge worry about an intellectual property drain, and and just a brain drain in terms of the engineers. Think about that. 3,200 engineers and technical workers have left Boeing in the last year and a half.
Wow.
Those are the people that are putting together the software, figuring out how the planes are supposed to fly, how the engines, all of that stuff. And so, that's a significant amount. I know you're a big union guy, Tom. SPIA, everybody knows the aerospace, the engineers union. They had about 23,000 employees locally in 2010. That's down 38% now. Because they've gone elsewhere, or Boeing has cut them, or they have outsourced. And you have times where they're 30-plus year employees who retire, and then a week later, they get a call from SpaceX like, hey, you want to come down to Kent? We're making a lot of money. Or Amazon. And so there's a big concern going forward if that pipeline of young go-getting engineers is there to make the next move, which is to continuing the space race, perhaps working on drones, maybe a new airplane, their first ground up since the 787. A lot of this will depend maybe on what happens on Friday, because the Starliner, Boeing's answer to SpaceX, which is basically the capsule, we call it the space taxi because it goes up and back to the space station. It failed its attempt in 2019 to lock up with the space station, so this is a big flight for them on Friday afternoon or midday for us. And if that's successful, maybe that'll re-energize things a little bit, put a little bit more confidence, a little more pep in the step for Boeing as they try to do that. But again, that's not a Puget Sound issue anymore. That's a Florida kind of thing. That's a not here, and that's a Boeing space and defense side thing too. So, but another either way, go ahead.
I was going to say another wrinkle in that in-depth article, as you point out, was that it was a strategy on Boeing's part to increase their bottom line. So they ended up cutting. Because they anticipated things were going to get tighter, and they're going to need to make sure their bottom line, came out looking better than not. But they think they might have cut too close to the bone, and other companies didn't do that. And so now that the world is ramping up faster than they expected, that strategy is kind of backfired. They thought they were being lean and mean, and now they realize that they perhaps overcut. And they've lost a lot of, talk about brain drain, they lost a lot of that brain drain under their own policy decisions.
Yeah, I mean, R&D spending down 23% and things like that. And I mean, let's face it, it was the idea of those charged the company the last decade or so to not go for the shoot the moon, not to go for the home run.
Right.
We need to pull things back in after we saw what happened without all the outsourcing. That's why we ended up with a re-engine 737, which has become its own particular issue, as opposed to a brand new single-aisle plane from ground up. They were like, hey, we don't need to make a whole new thing, spend a lot of money on it. Let's just re-engine this thing. And the bottom line, it comes down to this. Who do you want to keep happy? Your company or your shareholders? Why do you think Boeing has been doing so great in the stock market over the last 5 years? Because they've been doing things with their eye on the boardroom and maybe not necessarily on the health of the company to a lot
demand.
Of people. And I hear that from a lot of my engineer friends. I hear that from a lot of my mechanic friends who work on building these planes and whatnot. And that's one. It was a very strategic decision made to kind of focus that way. Let's make sure that we are profitable. A couple of years ago, they were making over $100 billion a year.
Wow.
I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
I mean, we kept going. When I started, it was like $56 billion. Then it's $72 billion, and then it was like, whoa! They just kept going and going.
And now we're celebrating a few hundred million.
A billion feels good.
Yeah,
it's something. This might have been in the article that I didn't get to at hour two, but I'm just curious. How do salaries factor into all of this in terms of competitiveness? Are people moving to these other companies just because it's more exciting, they're more cutting edge, or is there a real salary increase from that of Boeing's?
Well, I mean, they get paid pretty well, but in this article, it does address that they can move to a place like Amazon and make more money. or other places and make some more money. But for a lot of these people, as is pointed out in this article, and I can back this up with the people that I know personally, it isn't aviation av geeks, as we call them. You know, they're a different breed. People who are interested in aerospace and flight, the money's never really been the object for the people who design these things. It's about the, you know, going out there, making it faster, making it bigger, making it more fuel efficient, watching it fly. I mean, if you've ever been out to one of those where they debut an airplane, it makes its first flight, and their engineers there are just, you know, it's like they're watching their children walk for the first time. And it's really cool. I was there, I got the fortune to see the 87 with its first flight at Payne Field. And, you know, you just feel this. It's a different kind of thing where money isn't necessarily the driver. It's the exploration and just the juice of aviation that I think has gotten a lot of these people involved in this. I mean, the money would be great, sure. I mean, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, for some people, that makes makes decisions. But for a lot of these people, they're just wired for aviation, and it's what they love.
It's also just the luck of the draw, or Boeing's bad luck streak, that Amazon is based in basically Boeing's backyard. So you don't have to uproot your family or anything.
Nope.
You could be a high flying engineer at Boeing and say, yeah, you know, I think I'll go to Amazon and not even have to move.
No,
you're already right there.
Yeah, you might have to pay the 520 toll, but, you know, I-90 is still
at those
free.
Those rates, they can afford it. Yeah, too. Very good. Okay, Chris, I think you're right. It's been too long. I hear you all the time on G and Ursula, so I feel like I talk to you practically every day anyway. But you're right. You haven't been on with me, and I'm happy you made it today.
Well, it's always great to talk to you guys.
Chris. See you, Chris. All right, there he goes, Mr. Cherry Pie, Chris Sullivan, knows everything there is to know about, I was going to say traffic, because he does know about traffic, but Boeing is also his beat. But now, turning to our traffic guru, Tracy Taylor, how are we looking out there? You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. John Curley away today. He will be back tomorrow and filling in, as she often does, Sherry Elliker. So this is the time of the show where we want to applaud and compliment Muckleshoot Casino for having the foresight to introduce our next big guest, Rachel Bell. Always.
Thank you. Hey, can I tell you something?
Oh, tell away.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Last weekend, I went to a yard sale, and for $7.50, I bought this pair of candy machines, the kind that you put a quarter in and you turn it. I mean, like, the real thing. And now what I was afraid of is happening, because nobody is here except for me, and I'm eating all the candy. And just before I started talking to you, I was shoving Reese's Pieces in my own face. So it's backfiring. I mean, $7.50 was a good deal, but is it good for my life?
Well, now, wait a minute. Do you have to pay to get it to turn each time? That's going to be costing you a pretty penny.
Yeah, but I am the boss of the machines. I'm their manager. So I put the money in, and then I take my own money out and
out.
Put it in again. Also, I just have
what
taken
a capitalist.
I've taken to opening the big lid and just taking a handful out of the top, so it's like
did it come with candy already, Rachel, or did you have to provide the candy?
I personally wouldn't have wanted candy from 1986, which looks like when these machines were built. So I put my own in, but it's going to cost so much money to fill them up. I bought this huge family bag of peanut M&Ms, and it's filled 2 inches of what appears to be a 14-inch. So far, I've spent $20 on candy, and it would take, I think, $100 to fill up my $7 machine. But if anybody wants to see it, there is a picture on my Instagram page. Hello, Rachel Bell.
That's fantastic. You know, I don't know if you, I don't think of you as much of a candy eater, but what you could do is sort of like what John does by puts aside like $350 at the beginning of the year for whatever parking fees he gets. It'll just come out of that. So he already sets it aside. You could put like, you know, whatever it costs, $50 worth of candy, whatever it fills it up, and say, okay, I'm not going to eat another piece of candy outside of what I've already put in here. A sunken cost, so to speak.
Yeah, but I wouldn't do any of that. I'm too lazy. I wouldn't even bother to fill up the machine. It would be like, why am I taking this extra step? I'll just eat it out of the bag.
Because you spent $7.50.
Yeah, first of all, yeah, I guess if you like process, then it's fun to like use the machine and all of that. Me, I just want to, you know, I just put it in my mouth.
Well, speaking of old timey,
if it's a gimmick, I'm into it. Oh yeah, old timey. Okay, so there's this article in the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Yes. So over the years, and you guys more than me have experienced a lot of different technology for how you listen to your music. So it went from records to 8-tracks to cassettes to CDs, you know, Napster, and then people had iPods. And a lot of us can't listen to those particular, you know, physical pieces of music anymore because we don't have the player that works for them anymore. So many people now use MP3s or Spotify, you know, Apple Music, all of that. So this article is asking, what is going to happen to my music when Spotify dies, just like, you know, cassettes did, CDs did, etc. Like, it's not going to last forever. And so the author talked to a few experts, and one person named Brewster Kahle, the founder of Internet Archive, put it very bluntly and said, you're screwed. All of the experts on media preservation said that there is good reason to fear it, because the thing I didn't think about, a good way of putting it, is when you have a subscription to Spotify, you're renting your music, you know, you don't own any of it. So basically you're relying on those companies to A, stay in business, B, to renew its agreements with those, you know, musicians. They don't have to be on those channels. Like, they could pull out. And so they said the same thing is true for ebooks and movies that are only streaming. You know, if you don't own anything, you're going to lose your collection. But I don't know how big of a risk this is, because we live in this time where there are so many people constantly updating technology. Technology updates at a speed that is hard to comprehend compared to how it used to be even 20 years ago. So I'm sure there will be something else that will come along always. I think that there will be a way. Someone will invent something, don't you think?
Well, this article I found fascinating, because I'm running up against the same thing in terms of the, you know, the visual medium, like movies and audio tapes. So I'm fascinated by the concern. But I thought he made a pretty good case that we're not saving everything. It's just like, oh, isn't it great, you know, Amazon Prime or Netflix, we can watch any movie we want. We just call it up. And then you realize, oh, no, it's any one of the 5,000 movies, you know, that they're actually sponsoring. And it takes a place like Scarecrow Video to carry, you know, 37,000 or whatever, however many movies, because there's just not enough. There's not enough commercial interest to justify holding on to these things. So right now I'm really concerned that archivists aren't going to have enough money to save all these things. There's at least in the movie world, it's appalling to people, movie lovers, and I realize that we may be a niche audience, but that there are so many, 2/3 of the movies that were made like before 1930 just disappeared. They were on nitrate. They just they burned up, or they were thrown away, and because they weren't valued. The fact that we don't have access to a history of movies at its very beginnings really bothers me. But then, as he points out, listen, that's life. You know, history, we want to, I mean, we may think that the United States, the greatest country in the world, is going to last forever, but no civilization has lasted forever. So you just got to accept the fact that fate and life and history are malleable and are bound to go away eventually. Disturbing,
but
I found.
I do think that there are some particular niches where it can be dangerous. I mean, you know, now that we're still, you know, not even a year away from the second surge of the Black Lives Matter protests, and, you know, there's been a lot of changes over the last year. I've read and watched several things talking about, you know, Black African-American people who invented a lot of things in this country, were the founders of a lot of things, and you've never ever heard of them before. And that's because you know, if it was coming from slaves, there were no records kept, people didn't care, they didn't consider them people. And so I think that, you know, there are certain things, like, you don't know what's kind of slipping through the cracks, and if there's any kind of bias through that, if it's through film or music or books or whatever. I think it is important to preserve things to make sure that you have history right.
Absolutely. And the thing is, driving me crazy right now, I'm going through, slowly but surely going through my basement. I'm running across all sorts of old videotapes, you know, like home movie videotapes and all these kinds of things. They're all VHS stuff. And it's like, it's so old, you can't find something to make it. And so then you want to preserve it. Well, I want to turn everything into a DVD. Well, DVDs are already ancient business. And they say, You can just stream it. I said, I don't trust that cloud. I want to have something physically in my hand. It's like an impossible. It's like trying to hold back the dam. It's breaking out, and you got one thumb and one. In one hole, and the rest of the dam is breaking.
You better
through.
Get to that this weekend, Tom.
Yeah, I know. I've been doing it nonstop all damn summer.
It's never going to end. I know you, and I know your house, and you don't get far because you're so sentimental. You stop and you look through everything, and you're watching every movie you find. Basically, you're just resorting things. You're not getting rid of anything.
That's exactly right. The truth
I know
is
you,
out.
My friend.
You do indeed. Okay. Thank you, my friend. So much. That's there's the Uptown Girl, Rachel Bell. We'll see her on her way. There we go. The cue of the music. And now let's cue back in Tracy Taylor on Trap. Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here, Sherry Elker filling in for John. So, for some reason, the Tom and Curly Show has had this odd obsession. I don't know if it's all on Jacob or not, but we've really been following relatively closely the Jeopardy new guest host list. And we did a story a couple days ago about the fact that there was one guest host who was going to get his tryout because of this huge social media campaign. That indeed was LeVar Burton, and he had his debut on Monday. And I happened to watch it. Like I said, I think I set my DVR to record the first couple of episodes after Alex Trebek died to sort of see how they were going to handle his death. And I've never taken it off recording. So now I have something like 117 episodes of Jeopardy on that I could watch. So I watched it in the comfort of my own time to watch the LeVar Burton business. And what's great about it for me, at least, is that I saw a historic episode, but it wasn't because of LeVar Burton. I don't know how much time we have, so I want to jump. The reason I want to jump over the LeVar Burton, if we have time, we'll sneak in how he sounded. But there was a guy, a contestant, he was in the middle slot. His name was Patrick Pierce, I think. Yeah, Patrick Pierce. Mm-hmm. And he ended up setting the record for the worst score in the history of Jeopardy. He ended up with minus $7,400.
Poor guy.
And I love this guy, though. He had this perfect attitude. He was wearing, he had the kind of a casual suit. Sometimes people were wearing a casual sweater. Sometimes people were wearing suits and all this. And he seemed to have a good sense of humor because he kept swinging for the fences and kept missing. And so here he happened to be the lucky winner of the daily double attempt. This is his effort. Again, I don't know if he was down by 2,000-3,000 at this point, but here is Patrick Pierce's daily double effort.
The daily double. Patrick, how much would you like to wager?
I'd better wager 2,000, please.
Here we go. This emirate, a 100-mile-long peninsula on the East Coast, has taken a more independent line than its neighbors in recent years.
What is Abu Dhabi?
Sorry. Qatar. We're looking for Qatar.
Popes for 2,000, please.
Pius XI revived the custom of giving this blessing, whose Latin name means to the city and to the world. Patrick.
Was ecumenical?
No.
Sorry, I left that a little bit long because
no, that's good. Yeah, so he managed to get two off in a row. Well, what's great about this guy's, because sometimes he got, big answers. This happens a lot now that I've started watching Jeopardy again after a 30-year lapse. That, people, you're up 1,500 and then you lose, and you lose big, and then you climb back up. That people do this all the time. But he kept swinging and missing. And he had this perfect attitude. And what I thought was fun about the show for me was that I had never seen a show where somebody had a negative end result. And so I was wondering, how are they going to handle the final result? And that he was banished from the stage. He literally had to leave the stage for the final two. Do we have that clip of how it's announced?
This word can refer to a craving or an Asian currency.
Not.
Matt.
What's yen?
Yes. That means we're out of time. And unfortunately, okay. Patrick, you're in the negative and won't be joining us for Final Jeopardy. But Matt and Kathleen, you will.
So he had to ignominiously leave the stage. And then I kept it on to watch to see, because at the end, the guest host always chit-chats with everybody to see if he'd be allowed back on. And sure enough, he was allowed back on. So he had to leave the stage and then return to the stage.
Does he come back? Does Patrick come back with his wallet and hand out the $7,400 bucks that he owes now? Or how do they handle that?
I think the way they do it is that you're automatically, if you're the third out of three, you automatically win $1,000 bucks. If you're second, you get $2,000. So he ended up making a little money, but I don't know how he feels. My guess is, just based on the little 30 minutes I saw of him, he's probably fine with the notoriety of being the worst Jeopardy contestant in history. At least he stands out. And poor LeVar Burton thought all the attention would be on him. He wasn't even, he's barely mentioned. By the way, oh, very good. Is that Sean's contribution? He's actually, I think, a well-adjusted, happy loser. And so I'm rooting for, I know they want to bring back a guest host. I think they ought to do a tournament of anti-champions and bring the three
the worst of the worst.
Oh, yeah, and see how they would do. Let one of them experience the championship feeling for something.
Good idea.
But anyway. It was great fun. Are you just? We have to wrap this up. But were you ever a Jeopardy fan? Do you watch it much now or ever, Sherry?
I never was. I just feel so stupid when I watch it. I mean, I owe them like $8,000. I mean, more than that. You know, No, I mean, I do watch. I have watched it. I enjoy it. But boy, do I get nothing. I get nothing right.
That's funny. My 90-year-old mother, she watches it occasionally, and she says it's amazing. I keep watching the show, but I never get any better at it. And I said, Mom, I don't think that's how it works, you know, but still. Okay, I hear Tracy's music. We are getting later and later to you, Tracy. I apologize, but how do things look quickly on the highway?